The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting to order, and I'd like to start by having everyone introduce themselves. I'm going to start with Mr. Ramey.
Gary Ramey, MLA Lunenburg West.
Good morning, Matt Wynott, MLA Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Brian Scobar, MLA for Cumberland North.
Good morning, Clary McKinnon, MLA Pictou East.
Morris Smith, MLA Antigonish.
Andrew Younger, MLA Dartmouth East.
Chuck Porter, MLA Hants West.
Jacques Lapointe, Auditor General.
Darlene Henry, Committee Clerk.
Ian Bauer.
Kevin McNamara, Department of Health and Wellness.
Summers, Health and Wellness.
Benny, Chief Finance Officer, Health and Wellness.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Keith Caldwell, MLA for Preston. I'd like to welcome the Department of Health here this morning, and I would ask you to proceed with your opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have with me, as mentioned, Emily Summers, who is our provincial lead on the Better Care Sooner initiative at our department, as well Linda, who had mentioned, as Chief Financial Officer, as well as Ian Bauer, who's the Executive Director from Primary Health Care and Emergency Health Systems. We are pleased to be here today to discuss the advantages and the changes in our healthcare system. As you know, these changes have been driven by Better Care Sooner, government's plan to improve healthcare in Nova Scotia. Our work to improve healthcare systems began with the appointment of Dr. John Ross and his appointment as a provincial advisor on emergency care in Nova Scotia. Dr. Ross is a highly respected emergency room doctor with years of experience. His research on the Nova Scotia system and his report entitled The Patient Journey Through Emergency Care in Nova Scotia has provided us with a roadmap in our plan to improve emergency and primary care. The Better Care Sooner Plan was introduced in December of 2010. It is government's response to the Ross report. Ultimately, our Better Care Sooner plan is focused on the patient experience and how we can enhance the patient journey through the healthcare system. Better Care Sooner contains 32 action items and is designed to provide and enhance access to physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, streamline the patient-centered emergency care for seniors, people with mental illness, and others with complex needs, appropriate use of paramedics, and the 811 nurse line. Using Better Care Sooner as our roadmap, the Department of Health and Wellness has undertaken innovative approaches in a number of different areas. For example, we have opened Nova Scotia's first two collaborative emergency centers, one in Parsborough and the second in Spring Hill. Collaborative emergency centers provide Nova Scotians living in smaller communities extended primary care hours, same day or next day access to appointments with family physicians or other healthcare professionals. and 24/7 access to emergency care. Overnight, CECs will be staffed by nurses and/or paramedics working with EHS physician oversight. Other CECs are targeted this year in the communities of Tatamagoush and Annapolis Royal, and others to be announced in the near future by the minister. Since the CEC was launched in Parsborough in July, over 4,800 patients have been seen during the daytime hours and nighttime visits. And nighttime visits have been cut in half because individuals are getting access during the day. We started the extended care paramedic program in 17 nursing homes in Capital District Health Authority. Under this program, skilled EHS paramedics assess and treat nursing home residents in the facility. These patients get the care they need at home, so they do not need to visit the hospital in non-emergency situations. Seniors receive a plan for follow-up care in their facility or transport to hospital at a later time if this is necessary. As part of the Emergency Health Service Life Flight, the Department of Health and Wellness has added an aircraft which is dedicated solely to emergency health care. This aircraft is used to transfer critical care patients in Nova Scotia and throughout the Maritime Provinces. We invested in a two-stretcher ambulance. This ambulance is situated in Glace Bay and will transfer non-emergency patients between the Cape Breton Regional Hospital and the facilities in the Cape Breton Regional Municipality and Halifax. It is increasing efficiency in our healthcare system and better protects the health and safety of Nova Scotians by freeing up the availability of other ambulances for emergency responses in their own community. We opened the rapid assessment unit at the Halifax Infirmary. In its first year, this unit provided care to almost 2,900 patients at the QE2, diverting the majority of them away from the busy Charles V. Keating Emergency and Trauma Center. This has created more space in the Emergency and Trauma Center for patients who need emergency care. It also resulted in fewer patients waiting on stretchers, allowing EHS paramedics to get back in the community sooner. Without this unit, overall wait times in the Emergency and Trauma Center would have been higher over the past year. We opened 8 new hospital beds at the Halifax Infirmary. These beds are helping to reduce overcrowding and bottlenecks at the province's largest emergency center. Right now in Nova Scotia, we have trained advanced care paramedics who can immediately give life-saving drugs to Nova Scotians having heart attacks rather than having them wait until they arrive at a hospital. Across our province, you can now call 911 and receive care sooner at your door if you experience a heart attack, rather than delay treating by driving to an emergency room. By the way, we're the only province in Canada that has this fully provincial-wide. We have hired nurse practitioners to work in certain nursing homes across Nova Scotia. Nurse practitioners contribute to more effective and efficient patient care for residents, help reduce wait times in emergency rooms, and most importantly, give seniors the care they need at home. We've rerouted stroke patients to specialized units across the province. Starting in November of 2010, stroke units were open across the province in regional hospitals, and ambulances now take stroke patients directly to these hospitals to receive care. These units are located at Socio Regional Hospital, Yarmouth Regional Hospital, Valley Regional Hospital, Colchester Regional Hospitals, St. Martha's Regional, as well as Cape Breton Regional and the QE2. We released 2 Emergency Department Accountability Reports. Since 2010, government has been releasing annual ED accountability reports. These reports provide accurate, reliable data to better understand the challenges facing the province's emergency care system. We launched a public awareness program to increase the understanding of 811 and 911. We're also helping Nova Scotians make informed decisions about their health care needs through AIR 811 nurse line. Currently, an average of 500 Nova Scotians call 811 daily. Since it has become operational 2 years ago, over 100,000 Nova Scotians have received health care advice to this service. Another big investment we have made is in new or replacement nursing home beds to make life better for seniors and their families. Seniors are also benefiting from concrete steps we took to reduce drug costs. Our Fair Drug Plan means seniors and families enrolled in pharmacare are paying less for their generic drugs. and we have saved $6 million so that we can invest in other drugs and programs Nova Scotians need and want. For example, patients receiving palliative care at home are eligible for full drug coverage at no cost with the launch of the new expanded palliative care home care drug coverage, which was started in February of this year. We are making it easier for those who want to remain in their homes as long as possible. We've brought in improvements for seniors, such as the Home Adaptation Fund, the Caregiver's Allowance, and we ended security deposits for seniors in long-term care facilities. Here in Nova Scotia, our Better Care Sooner plan also places a priority on disease prevention in an effort to keep people well and to decrease stress on our healthcare system. For the past 2 years, we have been providing free flu shots to all Nova Scotians. And as part of a commitment to deliver better care sooner, government is developing our province's first ever mental health and addiction strategy that will improve these services for Nova Scotians who need them. The Minister of Health and Wellness will release this strategy later this spring. While much has been accomplished, there's still some work to be done on a better care sooner plan. Next year, working with the district health authorities, Nova Scotia will be the first province in Canada to begin implementation of standards for emergency departments. Under Better Care Sooner, the Department of Health and Wellness will also focus on improving patient access and flows in our ERs and creating senior-friendly emergency care. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share this with you, and we look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Our first question will be Mr. Younger.
It's 15 minutes?
20 minutes.
20 minutes, all right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your remarks. I want to start by asking actually about something that you referred to, which was the collaborative emergency centers. It's interesting that the Minister of Health keeps talking about five, and we obviously know where those are, but as you just said, only two of them are open, and nobody seems to know when the others will open. But I would even actually like to ask you about the two that you said are open, Parsborough and Spring Hill. Can you tell me when Spring Hill opened? Because just the other day they said it wasn't. In fact, it's still on their website from a couple of days ago.
Spring Hill, the CEC in Spring Hill opened March 28th.
Oh, okay. That explains it because I'm looking at March 26th and it's saying it's not open. So yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that clarity. Thank you very much. When can we expect, the Minister of Health keeps going around and saying that there are five collaborative emergency centres, and we know that those would be Spring Hill, Tadmagush, Pugwash, Annapolis Royal, Parsborough, so we know where they are, but when are the other three going to open?
Ms. Summers?
Sure. Each of the districts have submitted proposals for those that were identified by John Ross. Each of them are identifying when and if they are ready to open a CEC. So we have received proposals from Tatamagush, Annapolis, and Musquodoboit Harbour. And we are in the process of reviewing those and providing them the green light to proceed. We expect three more to be opened in this spring.
Okay. I'm sure you can understand the concern of some of these communities who, in the big announcements in the fall, that these were happening, and in fairness, maybe they didn't understand the process that would be involved in that, but they've sort of been sitting around waiting and suffering through ER closures ever since, thinking that that was coming to an end. I wanted to ask about something else that I find amusing that gets listed in the Better Care Sooner plan, which is the Dartmouth General Hospital, and it actually lists it on the website and so forth as a renovation. Yet the minister's own comment, I was at the press conference, and I'll even table the remarks by both the minister and the others that actually say it's not, that this is just a plan to look at a possible potential future renovation, and there is no government commitment for funding that renovation at the moment. So I wonder if you could clarify that, and I'll certainly table that those comments from the time.
Mr. McNamara?
Yeah. I'll be happy to answer that. Yes, it is a phase, which is the planning process, but there is a commitment to honor that planning and to make that a reality. So it will occur. I can't give you
the minister says it isn't.
Pardon me?
The minister and Chris Power says it isn't. So can you, they say that this is just a commitment to this phase, and in fact there is no commitment to the actual construction. So can you explain the discrepancy between what you're saying and what the minister's saying?
What I'm saying versus it will be built into the future budgets of when it will, the construction dollars will be spent. So I think that's what the difference is. But I mean, we're not going through a planning exercise just to plan.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, because we've been through this planning exercise before for the fifth floor of the Dartmouth General.
Well, the commitment that my understanding is that it will be a commitment to build and to fix.
All right. There was also a commitment. Has the RFP gone out for that? Because as far as I can tell on the government website.
I don't think the RFP has gone out yet. I think they're in the works of doing that at the present time.
Do you know what? I guess you can understand my concern. This was announced in December, that an RFP was imminent, was the words used at the time. We're now into April, and the results of that RFP and study are supposed to be back, according to the minister, by the end of the summer.
The thing that is happening is this is done through Capital Health, so they're doing their planning with their staff, and once that is completed, the RFP will be let.
I do understand, Mr. Chair, that it's done through Capital Health, but we're here talking about Better Care Sooner, and the Better Care Sooner plan is claiming that the renovation is going ahead, and I think you probably understand where my concern is. I have a minister and the CEO of Capital Health saying there is no commitment, very firmly, that there is no commitment to do the construction, that they're going to look at it. Also saying in December that RFP was imminently going out, and that there is no RFP out at the moment, and that the results will be back in the summer. Well, when the media asked about this at the press conference in December, they said the reason it had to go out imminently is because it would probably take 8 months to do that, so, which makes sense. You know, I don't dispute that sort of 6 to 8 month time frame to do that design or to look at the cost and design. But if that's the case and the RFP hasn't gone out yet, and say it goes out tomorrow and it takes 30 days to review an RFP, or just for the sake of argument, which is probably pretty quick, that puts it in May and puts 6 to 8 months, not at the end of the summer, but into next year.
I've just been advised the RFP is in the final draft and should go out within 2 weeks.
Okay. Do you know when will it still be back? Will the results of the study still be back at the end of summer, as the minister promised?
That's my belief.
All right. So they're going to do a shortened timeline then?
Well, they're going to do the work, and then we will be able to go forward. But my belief is that the Dartmouth General renovations will go forward.
Yeah. And listen, I hope they will. I really do. And when I was at that, and the reason I'm asking about this is because, you know, I was there at the press conference, and I said, and I was quite open to it. I said, listen, I hope that this does go ahead. However, we've been through this before. A previous Tory government did the exact same study and had the plan, and we can drag the plan out here and look at the plan for the fifth floor that never got funded because of other priorities and budget pressure. So, you know, I personally sat in the ER waiting to see a doctor the other day two or three weeks ago now, for 4 hours because they were overcrowded. And that's fine. Like that, I understand that happens, but there were a lot of people there and a lot of people who were much more serious, with much more serious injuries than I had, waiting. And the planning does nothing to solve the overcrowding at that hospital. And you can understand when there's a lot of people serviced by that hospital, have heard that there'll be a study before.
Well, the things have changed when the original plan was done for Dartmouth General.
And that's why
the replan has to occur. In talking to the Dartmouth General Hospital Foundation, we have asked them to raise their 25% of the capital cost. I would not be, and the government would not be asking them to raise 25% if there was not a commitment to move it forward.
Okay, then that brings up the next question. If you're asking them to raise 25% of the capital cost, at that announcement, the minister wouldn't actually put a dollar figure on. In fact, what I just tabled there actually has Chris Power saying, well, obviously we can't because we haven't had studies. So I appreciate that you've asked the foundation for 25%. So if you've asked them for 25%, you must know what 100% is going to cost, or a ballpark. So they can't raise 25% of with.
As you know, the Dartmouth General Hospital has been raising money for a number of years towards its renovation, so they've had a head start. And in fact, in meeting with the chairman of the foundation last week, we discussed about the commitment of 25%. We don't know the exact amount until the RFP is completed, but they are putting their team together to go out and complete the fundraising once they have a final target.
Yeah, and I'm sure Mr. Conrad told you, just as he's told me, that it's pretty hard to walk into to businesses or individuals or and say, well, listen, we're raising money for this, we have to do 25%. And I know they're very eager to help, but it's hard when they don't know what that that total dollar figure is. So I appreciate that you've asked them to raise 25%. Right. I have every confidence that they will do that, but you know, there's a big difference if it's 25% of a million or 25% of 20 million, right?
I agree, and I think we've learned from the past in what governments have done in the past of announcing a target and then not being able to meet it. We want to make sure that the full evaluation is done so we don't end up like we did in Colchester.
Yeah, I agree. And listen, I completely agree with that, but I think that gets right back to my original concern is I think the minister was quite honest, to be frank, and Chris Power was quite honest at that press conference when they said, both of them said, we're not going to commit to this construction until we actually get that RFP back and know what it's going to cost, which sort of fits with that whole Colchester thing that, my goodness, if it comes back and it's outrageously expensive, then, you know, we have to scale down or we have to figure out what we're going to do. You know, it has to be affordable, right? I think we all agree that. But you're telling me that, if I understand you correctly, that it's going to go ahead, that construction.
That is my belief. We know they're aiming towards two operating rooms that have to be added to that area, plus a number of beds. I think it's approximately 50. That's to infill the floor that's already there.
Yeah.
So
I know I've been on the floor. Yeah. So it's a nice big empty floor.
So my belief is we would not be going out to this route if it wasn't to come to a completion. I think one of the things we've been trying to, in this government and our department are trying to do, is not to commit to things we won't do. So we're trying to make sure that we have a game plan in place. Yes, we'll be going to government for the actual amount of construction costs once we know what it is, as we will to the foundation.
Yeah, well, I think, I guess I'll say to that is what I said before, that the study has been done before, and I appreciate your commitment. And listen, I absolutely hope that you're right. I really, I very honestly do hope you're right, but I think you can understand, as someone who's spent my whole life living in Dartmouth and has seen plans for the fifth floor been funded and done by government and then the construction not followed through, and this really isn't much different than promising to lower the HST, that it comes after future election. It isn't within the mandate of the current government, and it relies on future commitments, and that's where it gets troubling. The other question I have about that is, and I'd like to know whether this has changed, is Ms. Power said at the time that this would not actually be additional beds that would be created by this, but would be a shifting of beds, or most likely be a shifting of beds from other Capitol Health sites. And there'd be two new operating rooms, or that's what they're looking at, but that the beds that would be created on the fifth floor of the Dartmouth General actually would just be a transfer of beds from other sites.
I think what Ms. Power said was that there would be a shifting on an interim basis while there's work done to replace work around the VG. So that's why so you have to look at the Capital Health as a full entity, yeah. And then over time you do the second part.
So will there be a net increase in beds in the Capital District system after this is all done?
Eventually there will, yes.
Okay, eventually. And I appreciate that there's different construction projects going on. When you say eventually, what kind of timeline are you talking about?
I can't give you that exactly. We also know
that even a ballpark is fine. I'm not going to hold you to, like, if you say 4 years and ends up being five, that's fine.
I can't even do that. I can also tell you other things that are taking place. As over the next 5 years, the federal government is pulling out of covering veterans' beds. So we know that the veterans unit will become available to us as well as another opportunity. So we have to work that into the plans that are being developed.
When you call that an opportunity, what would you... Maybe I should ask it in a different way. With the federal government's change in involvement in veterans' beds, how's that going to impact?
It means that there will be no veterans in the veterans' building, so that facility will be available as well.
It'll be available, but it'll mean an additional cost to the Department of Health, I assume.
No question, and you have to do the appropriate renovations, and how we would utilize that space is what we'll have to work our way through.
Which means
that's part of the planning.
But, of course, those veterans will still need... need beds, whether they're provided by the federal government or provided by the provincial government, right?
My understanding from Veterans Affairs Canada is that there will no longer be those veterans around, because if you look at the age of them now, from the ones that they provided coverage for, there's newer ones coming up, and we have to work and figure out how we provide that care as well. But the my understanding from Veterans Affairs Canada is they intend to spend more on home care and less on institutional care. And this is not just in Halifax, it's across our province.
Oh, I suspect it's across the country too. Yes. And listen, I recognize that's not your decision, and I also appreciate the fact that you recognize that veterans are not just people that served in World War II or Korea or wherever else, that we have veterans today, and there are some people coming back from Afghanistan and some of our peacekeeping missions who are seriously injured and need care as well. So I think that that will be a potentially significant additional cost pressure in terms of because somebody's going to have to, and hopefully the home care will work, but home care doesn't work for everybody.
Again, the veterans' care is responsibility of the federal government. I think we all collectively have to hold them accountable for that and make sure that...
I agree, but there's a lot of things that are responsible to the federal government that they abdicate from, so that doesn't... unfortunately, if they... to some extent, it's not much different than the OAS situation, that the provincial... It'll fall to the provincial government to deal with the gap between 65 and 67, which is a whole other department. It would be community services, and I recognize that, but I think just because I agree with you that it is a federal responsibility, and all of us will have to advocate on that. However, some of these things seem to still fall to the provincial government, whether we like it or not, when the federal government abdicates its responsibility. So here we have a situation with the Dartmouth General where eventually there will be new beds created, and that's fine, but the Dartmouth General is routinely in a code census. I think I'm going to do this by memory, so it might be slightly off, but it was something like 140 days last year that it was in a code census situation. It might be a little bit more, a little bit less, but there's a serious overcrowding issue at the Dartmouth General, as there are at other hospitals. There are many points to it, but one of the points of addressing the fifth floor issue was to try and alleviate that to some extent by creating additional bed capacity. And anybody that's been there knows that one of the issues is finding inpatient beds. In fact, the day that I was there the other day, that was exactly the issue. There was a number of people waiting for inpatient assignments, and they couldn't take other people in. And unfortunately, also a young person had a very serious accident and died, and that had taken up another part. So, with the word eventually, that fifth floor issue is not going to address the overcrowding in the near term, maybe not the medium term. So, what's the plan to address that?
Well, as on an interim basis, in fact, a couple of months ago, I met with both George McCall from EHS and Chris Power from Capital Health and talked about how would we first work on the ambulance offloading, because that's important as well. And so a transition team was put in place, including an RN and one of the paramedics to look at that. So how do we improve that system? There has been major improvements in Dartmouth on that. There's been some improvements in Halifax, not as much as in Dartmouth. We're also looking at what can we do to keep people out of ERs. For example, the issue of adding paramedics to go to nursing homes is one thing. We have to look at other avenues of how we can provide access for individuals to go see a physician. Because often people that end up, as you know, in ERs are there because they do not have an access to a health professional. So part of the Better Care Sooner is that part of that plan as well. We're also working our way through a physician manpower plan for the future so we can identify where we need physicians or other healthcare professionals and how best we do it. We're looking at how we can add other additional healthcare professionals, particularly in rural communities, looking at nurse practitioners. So, and even when we open our CECs, as we look at the Muscadabas, for example, it starts to relieve pressure off of Dartmouth General's ER. So it's a bunch of stages to get there. So we're trying to fix a lot of things in a short time. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen overnight.
And I realize and I appreciate that there has to be a long-term and a short-term plan.
That's correct.
And I realize there is no silver bullet to that. I think the where the disappointment comes for many people is they looked and said, for many years, many people, including myself, fought to have that fifth floor moved ahead. we'll be cautiously optimistic that maybe this time it will. But then we sort of hear, well, yeah, but it'll be years before we actually see that trickle-down effect from that, so we need to find another source. And all of those things you talk about are great, but so and Metro is a bit of a different situation than some of the rural communities in some respects. There are similarities, of course. So if you have a family doctor and you can't get an appointment, or you don't have a family doctor, there's a whole pile of walk-in clinics around Metro, and you can usually get in fairly easily. The problem is, just like everything else, they close at whatever time. Some of them close at 8, some of them close at 6, some of them are open weekends, some aren't. I know that those take pressure off the ERs, and they would take pressure off the QE2, probably Cobequid too, I assume. But they close. And so the physician problem isn't the only key to this on a metro basis, because if you have something serious enough that can't wait to the next day, and the walk-in clinic is closed Saturday night at 10 o'clock, you have no choice but to go to an ER. And that doesn't matter if it's a senior or that, and obviously some of that's taken by the paramedics. That's the short-term problem, as I see it, in terms of the urban ERs. And so how do you... creating a physician database and all that is not going to solve that problem, because they're still going home at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock or 6 o'clock, depending on whether they offer after hours. So, and that's where your code censuses are primarily happening, is in the overnight hours. So what is the short-term plan to address that? The long-term plan's fine. So fine. Let's assume that this all works out. You get additional capacity 5 years down the road after all the other stuff's done, or 6 years, whatever that eventual time ends up being. What is the short-term plan to address that, so that, because it's not just here, like you're having a trickle-down effect to QE2 and to Cobequid and everywhere else.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's steps. And one of the steps is just, for example, having paramedics go to nursing homes to prevent those individuals to end up in emergency centers. Our CECs that we're looking at is looking at same-day and next-day access as part of it. So as we develop those facilities in the Muscadelphis, for example, we'll have an impact on Dartmouth General, because individuals can be seen, like it is happening in Parsborough. One of the things we've learned from Parsborough is that we now have individuals from neighboring communities going to Parsborough for care because they know they can get an appointment either the same day or the next day. It's an improvement from the past of having to wait 2 weeks to see a doctor, which why is it many individuals end up going to ERs.
Order, please. Mr. Younger's time has expired. Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the committee today for being with us. A few questions. I want to start with the HS deputy, if I can. You had a comment in there about an addition. I might understand from this that you have two aircraft now working out there, okay, as needed.
I'm going to ask Ian to...
Sure, whomever is fine, yeah.
Sure, you. Yes. Yes.
So we have the helicopter. What else is there for an aircraft?
There's a fixed-wing airplane there as well now. Excellent. That's fully... It's actually in the process right now of being fully reconfigured to be a dedicated medevac airplane.
Is that in place and running now?
It is in place and running now. As I say, right now, that plane is actually out being fully reconfigured to meet all of our medevac needs for now and in the future. We have a temporary plane doing that right now for us. So they're both in service.
Great. I've been away from the business for a little while, so I wasn't sure. How long has that been in place?
Since November of 2011. Now, we've always had a plane as part of the configuration to back up the helicopter, but it was on a as-needed kind of basis. We decided in 2011, late 2011, under the Better Care Sooner plan, to dedicate the fixed wing to that capacity.
Thank you. And I was very familiar with, of course, the on-call availability of a fixed-wing aircraft. What was the additional cost brought in now? The budget would have obviously gone up from that resource that we've been providing for some number of years, a long time now. What's the addition there to the spending?
We actually have always had a budget to accommodate excess capacity, usually excess minutes for the helicopter. So we actually did rededicate some of our own existing budget to support the dedication of the fixed wing. So no incremental cost over our existing budgets.
Very good. Thank you. I want to jump to a number of things in my 20 minutes. Will go by rather quickly, as it always does here. Deputy, I'll ask you, and you can assign it to whomever you think is appropriate. I want to talk about dialysis for a few minutes. This time last year, we were in the estimates, and the budget stated there'd be $998,000, if my math is correct, allotted to dialysis in some way, shape, or form. I did question the minister throughout the estimates on that, and was given, you know, we were looking into that. We don't know what the, where it's going yet and so on and so forth. And about 2 hours after the estimates ended, I had a call saying, because part of my questioning was, are we going to see money extended to the Hants Community Hospital in Windsor? And the answer was basically, well, she couldn't commit to that or wouldn't commit to that, obviously, but the answer was no, which I did find out only a couple hours after the minister's estimates ended, which was, of course, discouraging. As you know, we've had a long-term effort going on there now in raising funds for dialysis. We have a number of patients that do come both this way and to Berwick, and they would certainly like to have something closer to home, especially with a facility there that's willing to offer it. And a community that is willing to support it. Now, I'll start with, of the $998,000, can you tell us where that money was spent?
Ms. Penny?
Perhaps I'm going to have to get back to you with the exact, where actually it was spent. We don't have that information with us, but we'll get that for you. But what I can say is a couple of things. One on dialysis. One is that we are doing construction at the Victoria General Hospital so that we can expand our home dialysis program, which is the way that we want to move for the immediate future. We think that that is better care for patients. We also think that it allows individuals to have dialysis in their own home. It also provides that we can do more people at the at lesser cost per individual. So it is a better way in our experience from individuals who have gone through it is that it is extremely popular for those individuals once they get into it. And as a matter of fact, we had a conference in Halifax of the physicians involved in dialysis as well as a couple of speakers from Upper Canada who were talking about the benefits of home dialysis, and the physicians have really bought into this and say this is a way of the future. It wasn't where their mindset was previous to this, and so they have believed and believe it is, it's a way to move in order to be able to, particularly with the increasing number of diabetics and those leading to diabetes, that we'll be able to afford and have an affordable program.
Thank you. It's interesting. I have locally heard from over 40, 45 people that travel one way or the other. Some who have been on home dialysis. Some who would say home dialysis does not work, obviously, for everybody. There's a fair bit of work to that. One, the training, the supplies. There are some circumstances, matter of fact, from what I understand, quite a few circumstances where it doesn't work or work well. Families are sometimes not comfortable, obviously, with doing that. And the other problem is that they lose even more ability to live a normal life because they're hooked up on this machine every 3 or 4 hours for a period of time every day, and it changes their life considerably. Not that traveling 3 days a week doesn't to a hospital one way or the other. It still takes a lot out of these people. Was any consideration or is there a percentage that you're getting hoping to get to? I would think it wouldn't be 100%, but I may be wrong on that. I'll let you answer that with regards to home dialysis. Is there a goal that you have set or that organization has set for, you know, as you spoke to, Deputy, the percentage of diabetes and the growing...
What the percentage is working to those that are appropriate to have home dialysis. And as you mentioned, it is very inconvenient for anybody that has to have dialysis. But one of the home dialysis, many of them can do it overnight as well. So it does give them the opportunity to live a normal life during daylight hours or during our normal awake hours, I will use that. And so the belief that we have in working with those physicians, it will work for a lot of individuals, but not, as you indicated, not everyone. But some of our existing facilities can take up those that cannot do home dialysis.
Now, there are people, it's interesting you say it, there are people that I've spoke to locally who are hooked up every 4 hours. They, all day around the clock, who are not living any kind of lifestyle anywhere near what we would, I guess.
I'm not the expert in dialysis here, so I'm not going to go.
That's fine.
I know that, but I do know in talking to these individuals that they talk about home dialysis being preferable. But for individuals for whom it works, and you're right, there are some that it doesn't, but again, I'm not the expert on that.
So the $998,000, if I heard you correctly, you can't tell me where that was spent, but I do know. I believe some of that was allotted for Dartmouth General, perhaps, and there were some at the queue here in Halifax. Now, in saying that, there's a gentleman by the name of Wayne Redden who comes from my area. Now, Wayne was part of a get-together, I guess we'll call it, in Windsor one day back last fall at a local Dr. Jane Halliburton had hosted this event with regards to diabetes and awareness and dialysis and so on. And Wayne spoke about, you know, he got up and he spoke in front of the cameras about traveling in and out of Halifax 3 days a week, what that meant for him. And he spoke about the money that it was costing. He spoke about the money that was being spent in the dialysis unit where he traveled to. And he said, you know, we had perfectly good chairs here, but yet we spent money on new chairs. How could we justify spending money on chairs when we have, and that's only one example, and I don't know what else it was spent on, Deputy, but how could we justify ever spending money to replace chairs that, you know, patients themselves are saying there were nothing wrong with the chairs we had? Why weren't we not investing that in other areas like Hants Community, where we have a community who has come together to say, we want to be part of this and providing this?
I can't speak to the specific incidents of those chairs, but I'll give you what my understanding is. Individuals who are on dialysis are very susceptible to infection, and sometimes the chairs wear to the point that they can carry germs from one to another, so the appropriate process is to replace those chairs.
Okay. Thanks for that. I would think that with all of our sterile technique, and I do know that things do wear, don't get me wrong, especially when you have people coming and going at the rate that they're coming and going and the numbers, and everybody does have a bit of a different circumstance. I don't doubt any of that or take anything away from that. But seeing it from the patient's perspective, you can appreciate where those comments come from and why the questions are asked. As you know, we've, or may not know, we have raised in the vicinity of well over $100,000 in the Hants community area. We have a commitment from people there who are interested in being part of that. I know that the long-term and the operational costs are always the piece that you as a government have to look at, and it's not just as simple as maybe purchasing the machines. I know that there's money to be spent in renovating an area at the hospital that would be probably quite a few dollars and making that what it needs to be. But at the same time, that commitment is there from an organization that has been working hard to raise money and do believe at some point that that will happen. I want it to happen. I will ask you this. From the government's perspective, will you ever see a time when this government would consider investing the dollars needed to make dialysis happen at the Hants Community Hospital in Windsor?
I do not see it in the foreseeable future.
In the foreseeable future. I'll take that as a direct no from the government that is here today that are not interested in investing in the people in the Hants community. And I'll ask this question on top of that, Deputy, then as well. And the justification behind that is that I don't want to put words in your mouth, and you can correct it. We're close enough to the HRM and to the other facilities that offered.
That's correct.
Is that the assumption of government today?
That is correct. I think you have to go back and say, for example, you can say, well, in our community, we raise money for dialysis, so we want this service. Another hospital can say, the community raised money for an MRI, we want one. We have to look at a provincial plan, so when we do our actions, it's based on a provincial plan, not based on somebody raising money and say, this, even though I can recognize for some of those individuals, it would be preferable for them, but we have to look at the bigger picture.
Yet we raise money and have for ever in the foundation and Hants community, as do other hospitals around the province and probably throughout the country. I don't know, but I know that we've raised money to put crash carts on the floor because government obviously says, you know, we can't afford to supply everything that you'd like to have. It does cost a lot of money. They do wear. There's all of these circumstances surrounding that. So people are, you know, they're obviously of the belief that we want to work hard. We do want it to happen. It is something that they think they're being treated as second-class citizens because of the need, the desire to have it locally, especially when you have an organization in the community who is raising money to try and help them and make that happen. There are people that I have out there right now that have been traveling for 15 years for dialysis, if you can imagine. There are people out there who are no longer there because they got weary and tired after traveling for many years. They just said, I can't do it anymore. And I've now since died and are gone because they just couldn't take the stress and the strain and all of the things that go along with that disease after you've done it for many years. That's very unfortunate. At the same
can I just interject? I think it's unfair to say second-class citizens. We have individuals in Digby that have to travel further. Mm-hmm. We have individuals in other communities that have to travel just as far or further as well. So we have to look, as I said, we're trying to deal with the provincial program. And, as I had indicated, I think, when I was here before, talking about diabetes, if we had the money to move a dialysis center, we would go to Digby first because of the distance, a greater distance they have to travel than any other individual in this province.
Well, then that's great. And to be very clear on this point, and I want to be very clear, that's not me saying it. That's the people saying it who are affected by it. And those people out there who are raising the funds who are affected by it. Those are family members who've seen their loved ones go, who are affected by it, who are saying that. So I want that just to be very clear here for the record today, where that comes from when it comes to the urban-rural divide. That is how they see it, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it. And I also take your point as well. There are people who travel farther. I understand that. The one in Berwick, dialysis center in Berwick, is moving to Kemphill, yes or no?
I don't know right now.
Okay. Was that not what was put out some time back?
I mean, I'm getting older, so my memory isn't as good as it used to be. But I can find out for you.
Okay. Thank you. And if you could, just on that, maybe in finding out the time frame for that to happen, if that is going to happen.
Sure.
Because what that does do is it does shorten up the drive, not by much, but probably by 10 or 12 minutes for those traveling from my area, and they will be interested in certainly seeing what is going to transpire there. So that would be fine. I want to move to how much time we got left, Mr. Chair? 5 minutes or so?
You've
6 minutes?
Until 9:51.
9:51. Thank you. I want to move to home care. The $400 that families apply for assistance in looking after the folks at home. I had a call yesterday on the way in, and I've asked for this actually to be sent to me in writing from the Department of Health, whoever they spoke to. This is a patient who's been, I think, 15 years now in dialysis, who has family, of course the costs that go along with that is phenomenal, et cetera, as I just spoke to. They have applied for this $400 caregiver allowance, you know, in buying into better health care sooner, all the things that government is trying to promote. They meet all of the requirements, the wage, all of those things, the income. They get a call, and the question is, does your husband put toothpaste on his hairbrush or his comb? Of course, the answer is no, he does not. He puts it on his toothbrush. Well, I'm sorry then, ma'am, Mrs. Francis LaPierre, you do not qualify because your husband is not confused enough. Now, I got to be honest with you. When I get this call, and I've asked for it because I can't believe this, I've asked for this in writing, and I'd just like to have your comments on this. How could you possibly be disqualified looking after a loved one, whether they are confused or not confused, if they have a physical need whereby they are disabled and at home, and meet every other requirement? I'm just amazed that I would even get this call, number one. But knowing we were here today, I couldn't let this go and not ask you your thoughts on this, Deputy. How could this be?
I honestly can't answer that because I don't know the circumstances. I don't have a clue of what you're referring to. So, I mean, if you get me the details, I'll look into it. That's
I'll get them. There's no doubt about that. And that's why I've asked for them, because I'm having a hard time understanding how it could happen. But even just the whole piece here now, I'm hoping, and we've heard all kinds of different stories on how people are disqualified on this $400 allotment over trivial things, or what they deem to be trivial. Now, in this case, they were told, you know, they meet all of those requirements. Why would somebody from the Department of Health, though, call up to ask about the status of somebody's cognitive ability? I mean, there must be an answer here somewhere. What is the process? I'll ask you this, Deputy. You fill out the paperwork, you apply. Can you tell me what the process is, or one of the folks with you, as to what happens after the application comes in the door?
No, I cannot. But I can find out for you. I mean, again, as a deputy, I don't get down into the details of everything that takes place in the department, but I will find out the process for you.
Okay, because that is vitally important to these folks, as you can well appreciate.
Yeah.
And they're frustrated would be putting it mildly.
But talking about home care, and I do know from my national work that Nova Scotia is leading the country in what we provide in terms of allowances for individuals. Having said that, doesn't mean that we aren't trying to do better. And as you will note, there's there's money in the new budget that to go for increased utilization and ways to look at home care as well.
And look, I think that's great. Having been a paramedic for a lot of years going to these homes, I think that the programs whereby you're using these advanced care paramedics are all great. Anything that you can do to prevent transfer, there's a huge cost. Believe me, I know it well and I appreciate it. I know what it does to tying up resources. Those are all good things. I would never take that away. And I think for the most part, people believe anytime, regardless of who's in government, that there are things that will help everyday people that are in those circumstances. They would look at those as probably being reasonable and being good things. But those examples of yesterday are very frustrating. When government stands up in the spring, announces a budget, and you know is preparing to win election sometime soon, maybe it's not this year, but we do know we're going, and saying all about how we're doing such a great job, and they, you know, and that's all, that's typical, that's not new, we all know that. But you know, and talking and using the philosophy and the words, better care sooner. You know, every night on a hockey game on TV, if you get time to watch it, primetime ads about better health care sooner. The news, better health care sooner. And we're spending, and that's my next question. I know I'm running out of time here. Can you tell me what we're spending on all of these wonderful advertisements that you're doing? I know that I did some research last year. It was well over $100,000 just for a very short period of time. What have we spent in the last year in TV advertisements for this campaign?
I'll ask Linda to give you the amount, but before she does, one of the things that we have learned is if we don't advertise, individuals not utilize those services, it would be a waste of money to pay folks to operate an 811 line if nobody called it. And the only way you become familiar is you go to the means that you can to get to individuals so they will access the service. When individuals call 811, it means they don't show up in an ER at times. It means that they can get good advice on how to deal with their child. There's a lot of positives from this. But yes, there is a cost to doing that. But if we don't advertise, the matter of fact is we won't have anybody calling. Linda, do you have the amount?
Ms. Penny?
Yeah, we've spent in total in the last fiscal year $388,400 on TV.
So just shy of $700,000?
$388,000.
And that is, that's just TV, or is that paper, radio?
That's just TV spots and promotion in March.
And TV spots and promotion?
TV spots throughout the year, and then there was a specific item for promotion of 811 in March.
What are the add-ons besides that? I'm going to assume, Linda, that you're doing radio or you're doing
So the total amount is $631,000, and I can break it down a little more for you. So we've got $900 for CEC advertising. I mentioned the $388,400 for the TV. We've got $119,100 for print and mail. We've also included a flu shot awareness campaign of $119,000.
Order, please. Unfortunately, Mr. Porter's time has expired. And you can continue that in the next round, Mr. Porter, if you like. Mr. Why Not?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and hopefully we'll be able to go on to some of the positive things in this whole Better Care Sooner plan. Just a few things to comment from my opposition colleagues. It wouldn't be a surprise to them that in the Better Care Sooner plan that was laid out on the checklist in the back of the report, it actually says launch a public awareness campaign. So unlike the opposition, when they were in government, they did things kind of off the cuff with no plan. And, you know, this is exactly what we have put forward in this in the Better Care Sooner plan. The other thing, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, the rules, I know in the rules of the House, we have to ask permission of constituents being named and their issues brought forward. Is that the same thing that rules here?
One second before we do. I'll ask Mr. Porter if he did have permission from the individual. If he did, it's appropriate. Mr. Porter?
Yes, indeed. That was asked in my conversation yesterday with him, and I'm very familiar with the rules of this House and this committee, having sat on it for a number of years, Mr. Chair, and that permission was granted, just so you know, for the committee.
So it is in order. Mr. Why Not?
Thank you very much. Also, just to set the record straight, I think in regards to the my honorable colleague from Dartmouth East, he talked about the fifth floor at the Dartmouth General. I know that the current Minister of Labor and Advanced Education, as well as many of our colleagues on the Dartmouth side, MLAs have been fighting even in opposition when in regards to the fifth floor. And I know that I'm glad to see that our government's moving forward on plans to use that space. Again, we don't put things on the back of a napkin and just say, unlike the previous government did with the Colchester Hospital. I'm glad to see that now we have in place a mechanism that the Auditor General actually pointed out in that regard. So now we're moving forward with an RFP process that I assume, Mr. McNamara, that new process that has been identified is now being used for the Dartmouth General upgrades. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that includes individuals from TIR to be involved with us to give us the appropriate expertise to make sure we're doing the right things.
Doing the right things and ensuring that we get the cost correct. Is that correct? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that before my blood pressure get any higher. I want to talk a little bit about my own personal experience with 811. I think this is a phenomenal service. I think that, most recently, it's interesting, one of the ads, in fact, talks about new situations that you may come into in your own personal life, and that certainly has happened for me over the last year with a new little one in my life. Within the first week of her being born, we had a situation where she wasn't breastfeeding. Obviously, that's a new thing for families. She wasn't she didn't eat for over 20 hours, and so we had a concern there. Obviously, so we called 811. They worked us through the system. They said, "Well, we think you should go to the IWK." Sure enough, when we arrived at the IWK, they knew we were coming. They had all of our information. We didn't have to go through registration, the long registration process that we usually have. And we were in to see a doctor within a half an hour. So these are the types of things that I think is such an important investment, that this whole mentality of, one of my questions is around this whole mentality of people that we need to get out of the idea that we have other healthcare professionals. We have to get into the idea of thinking that we have other healthcare professionals that are out there that need to be utilized, such as advanced care paramedics, paramedics themselves, RNs, LPNs, nurse practitioners, and of course our doctors. Do you see that changing? Like, is this something that especially with the idea of a CEC, are we seeing that change in Nova Scotia that we need to,
We are seeing a change. There's still a lot of work before it becomes to full fruition. For example, even on a national basis, and I'm doing a teleconference this afternoon with a number of my peer deputies, talking about medical training and how we get physicians to work in teams. Physicians are not trained to work in teams. They're trained as individuals, and then we sort of expect them to automatically do it. So part of the new medical education we're looking for is getting that to take place, so they'll take full advantage of other health professionals. We know that many other health professionals can take time away from physicians and allow them to spend more in-depth time with patients. We know that nurse practitioners, RNs, physiotherapists, OT can do a lot of work that in the past was done by the higher paid individual. So it is a change, and we are seeing, but we're on the cusp, but still a lot of work to go.
Yeah, because I know that at my wife's family doctor, they're starting to move in that direction of having patient-centered care, so that you can actually tap into the knowledge of all those other professionals. I know from my family doctor, one that I've had since I was much younger than I am now, she would always have 9 to 5 hours. 5 days a week. She's moving forward with having, maybe not being open on a Thursday, but she would then have 3 to 10 or have a weekend. Is there any incentive there for doctors? I know that part of the huge list of action plan here in the Better Care Sooner plan is to ensure that we have after hours or after, you know, what used to be considered after hours care. Do we see an incentive there for doctors to move that way?
With the CECs, we try to get physician coverage from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week, which so that goes changes from the them closing their office at 4 or 5, which they did in the past and went to the ER. So we have seen that change, and that's working in those communities where we've started it, and we'll be expanding it over time. We're also needing to work with physicians for those that are not part of CECs, how we can expand things in a different way. The other thing, as a matter of fact, I asked our staff to look at, even for physician coverage, is there a way that we can develop a fee so that individuals can, physicians can get paid if they do emails or do phone calls, which in the past they haven't been. So, for example, sometimes just an email to your doctor can solve a problem rather than having to come in and see someone, which because our existing system says if you don't have a face-to-face meeting, the physician can't get paid. We're looking at how we can deal with things of refilling prescriptions, other things that we can that can be dealt quite simply. So if we start changing more of that, it means that the doctor will provide extra hours in a different way.
I saw a news release the other day, I think it was yesterday or Monday maybe, about the e-filing system. Did I see that?
Oh, you're talking about the release and talking about Nightingale?
Yes, yeah. So how many... So my understanding was that there was two systems in Nova Scotia, right?
There's two main ones. There's a number of them.
But two main ones. So are we moving to one...
The premise that Nova Scotia was working at Nightingale was to be the system provider and the main one that we were endorsing and asking physicians to buy on. There's another smaller one, Practimax, that many physicians have been using. It's a locally grown, small operation. Some of the concerns we have, even though it's good in many ways, is what happens if we lose one or two of those individuals running that company? What happens to the... So we, the other thing that we're trying to work on is how we have a system that is interoperable. It means that the physician can communicate with the hospital, can communicate with the pharmacy. So the more systems you have, you have to spend a lot of money to make the systems talk to one another. One of the systems we have right now, even in our existing hospitals, don't talk to one another, and that's what we're trying to improve. Okay. And we need to get to a system so that a physician can get the information they need appropriately and accurately. It'll help us with many ways, from being able to do prescribing, being able to control our issues around narcotics. I mean, so as was mentioned in that press release, Nightingale is the only system that has been certified by Kent Infoway nationally, and which we're very proud to be participating in.
Okay, so I didn't realize within my own family doctor's, let's say, office, they don't talk to the hospital if I need to go get a test done.
Not in everything, no.
Is that right? Okay.
Where we have a good interconnectivity is in our ways around x-rays. And so the system does allow the hospital, it does allow a radiologist, does allow a physician. They can connect. That's probably our best system province-wide. Okay. We have to do some more work as we're continuing to do this, but there is some opportunities, but it isn't as good as we'd like it to be.
And there was funding from the federal government for this sort of upgrade, was there not?
It is through Canada Infoway. It's right. Usually 50 cent dollars.
Okay.
So we have to do matching dollars. And for example, we're working right now on a number of things, one being a provincial pharmaceutical information system so that physicians, pharmacies, and hospitals can communicate on prescriptions.
Okay.
And so we're going to that exercise at the present time.
Okay. You mentioned pharmacists. I know oftentimes we talk about nurse practitioners and LPNs and RNs and doctors. Where do pharmacists play in this? I know that we changed, if I remember correctly, I think we changed kind of how pharmacists play a role in the whole healthcare system. Are we seeing a positive outcome in that regard?
We still have more work to do. We're still in negotiations with the Pharmacy Association of Nova Scotia to get that finalized. But pharmacists on their own have also, majority of them are pretty good and try to help their patients as best they can. What we're trying to do is give them more opportunities to relate to patients and not to require a physician oversight when doing certain work.
Switch gears here for a little bit. I was up in Cumberland County recently, and I was speaking with someone who said to me that, when she used to live, or when prior to having a CEC, access to a CEC, she couldn't get a doctor. She couldn't see a healthcare professional for like a week to, 10 days. I know that this whole idea of a CEC sometimes makes communities a little anxious because they don't know what to expect. So she said to me that now that we have a CEC, I can go in and get an appointment today or tomorrow. Is the, when a community has been announced that they're going to have a CEC, does that, are we still seeing that anxiety from the communities, or are they opening up to the idea, seeing that they are successful in some areas, are successful in all areas, and is that anxiety still there for those?
Quite honestly, the anxiety comes more frequently from staff than it does from the residents of the community, and they do create some anxiety with individuals by reciting their fears. But residents in many cases are looking for it to come. They want access. They want to be able to go see someone. The great thing about having a facility open 24/7, regardless of who it's staffed by, means at least there's somebody you can go to if you need it. If you go to a facility and it's closed, you can be in real trouble. The other thing is, with having a CEC, they can call EHS and have an ambulance there very shortly and transport someone to a facility that can provide the necessary care. And that's no different than happens in many of our community hospitals at the present time. Even if you get a GP and a nurse, you still have to call and transfer if the individual requires a higher level of care than that team can provide.
Okay. I know our province has been recognized nationally for our innovative program where paramedics, provide care in the nursing homes. That's a newer program, I guess newer being in the last couple of months, right? Have we started to see benefits, in the system? I mean, I guess it's more of a shorter period of time, but I guess over time we'll be able to see those benefits. But have we seen short-term benefits? For instance, if there's a nursing, a paramedic, say, down at Northwood here, which I think there is. Is that correct?
I'm going to ask Ian to answer your question.
Are we starting to see benefits, so that we're not seeing, seniors being transported to the QE2 or the rapid assessment unit, that sort of thing?
Right. Mr. Bauer?
Thank you for the question. We are in a long-term evaluation of the program. It did start a year ago, basically from now, from where we are today. The benefit, though, that has been clearly seen is the transfer rate out of the nursing homes. So, over around 75%, of those residents, when they called the 911 in the past, those 75% of those folks, they all would have gone to the emergency department. But 75% of those callers are not going to the emergency department at all or the hospital at all and are being treated in their home place of residence. 23% thereabouts are actually having a coordinated transfer. So if they need some kind of test, that's being arranged with the hospital. So an ambulance will come and get them eventually, but it won't be come to wait in the emergency department. It'll take them directly to where they need to go in the hospital, gets done, and they go home. And a very small percentage, I think it's 3%, are immediate ambulance transfers. So in that respect, from a benefit, we can see that immediately. Residents have been very favorable, as with nursing homes, that people are staying in their homes.
Are we going to see an expansion of this? Like, are we going to start putting more nurse practitioners or paramedics in nursing homes?
The model will be unique across the province. We're going to evaluate this one to see about it, how it is portable across the province and how it may not be. I mean, Capital District does have uniqueness in the sense that there are a lot of nursing homes in a close geography.
Sure.
And it allows it to take place. There are different models, though, to achieve the same kind of results that we're going to evaluate, and those are some other things that we're looking at in this province now, through the ACP and through home visits and things like that, that we can affect the same kind of benefit, but maybe through a different way. So it may not look the same, and it may not be called the ECP initiative, but I think we can achieve similar ends in other communities throughout the province.
Okay. Now, just in that regard, I know, like I said, I know we've been recognized nationally for this. So we've, I think, won an award. Can you explain that award? And, sure.
Sure. The Public Administration of Canada partners with Deloitte and Touche, and they have innovation awards every year in a number of categories. And we really feel, and Nova Scotia has been positioned for some time within the EHS system to start to do different things than other EHS and EMS systems in the country. And we took that opportunity that presented itself in capital, and we've worked with it, we've evaluated it, we've done research on it, and we continue to do research on it and publish on it, and it's gaining a lot of interest and attention internationally. It's broken down traditional silos in the healthcare system, where you're actually seeing partnerships between family physicians and primary care providers and nurses in the nursing homes with paramedics and emergency physicians to do the best to keep residents in a place. So it is collaborative teamwork that's happening in real time. So we felt that it was warranted to apply and get noticed within the healthcare industry for this, and we were successful as a gold award winner at those awards and those national awards in Toronto back in January. Amongst, I will say, a lot of very interesting innovations going on in the country, mm-hmm. but this was one of those. So we're very pleased with that recognition for the program.
That's good to see, because I think, you know, again, we've always seen in many different subject areas and different topics, Nova Scotia has been last, and I think, you know, we're starting to finally see Nova Scotia could be coming first in a lot of different areas in healthcare, you know, and other, you know, economic development and the rest of it. Are other provinces calling Nova Scotia and looking at some of the things that we're doing, I would consider ourselves as a leader. Are other provinces calling us and saying, hey, what are you folks doing in this area, and what's your best advice on how we can incorporate some of the things that you're doing in our province?
Mr. McNamara? Yes, we are getting calls. And when I have meetings with my deputy peers, one of the things they'll ask is about how we're making some of the achievements we have made, particularly when we've been going through an exercise of reducing our budgets, particularly in DHAs, and yet still being able to put in new services that are innovative and new. The CECs is definitely of interest. It's one of the programs that may even be reviewed by the Council of Federation. So looking at the premiers had indicated we look at some innovative ways to provide health care. We're getting the same with some of our other programs around paramedics and how we're doing other work. So it is something that's great interest. But it's also fair to say that we try to explore ideas from other provinces as well, if we can see some good ideas to copycat. I'm a real believer we shouldn't be doing things 13 times, like has been the history of the past in this country.
Yeah, for sure. No, and I appreciate all the work, and I think the minister has done a phenomenal job in promoting this initiative. We are seeing benefits to all Nova Scotians, no matter where you come from, what age group you're in, for this plan. You see a lot of I go through the list here on the back of the document, and you know, look here and say, look, you know what, we have accomplished a lot here. I mean, you know, some of the things may not have happened in the year they said they would, but I think we're getting there. And I'm you know, you're the department, all of the partners from the top down, from the bottom up, healthcare professionals are the lifeblood of our system, and I want to thank them personally on everything that they've done to ensure that this plan it follows through on what the government has said we would do. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Younger.
10 or 15?
You've got 14 minutes.
14, let's see. I would like to, Mr. Chair, I'd like to start by following up on something that the member for Hammonds Plains Upper Sackville asked about, which was the pharmacists issue. In speaking with a number of pharmacists and so forth, one of the commitments when this new tariff model was put in place with all these great things that they'll be able to do once the policy is implemented and passed, and they were promised that would happen relatively quickly, my understanding that still hasn't happened. Can you give an idea of the status of that?
As I had indicated, part of it is negotiating fees. Anytime you get into negotiations, they never happen fast, whether it's with pharmacists, doctors, or unions, or other governments. And so part of that is getting that in place. But as I had indicated, most Pharmacies are professionals. They're still providing service as best they can. But pharmacists are also employed by large companies who are interested in profit. So that also dictates how fast things happen.
Yeah, I don't speak to that. I think that the issue isn't so much the fact that negotiations take a long time. It's the fact the government trumpeted that this was going to happen and made people feel like it was going to happen imminently, right away, and should have known that the negotiations would obviously take some amount of time. The public was promised by the Minister of Health things like renewals of routine prescriptions and all kinds of things when... some of which may happen, some of which might not, of course, depending on your negotiations, I assume. And in fact, when you talk to a lot of pharmacists now, they say, well, even when that's negotiated, it may or may not happen because it's unclear who's going to pay for that. And also, there are now, apparently, in some of these negotiations, some discussions around the need for some renovations at pharmacies to meet requirements around privacy, which actually some of them may make sense, but it's still a cost. For example, to do prescription renewal consultations and so forth. So can you, do you have an idea of when you can expect that policy to be in place?
No, I can't give, because as I said, we're in negotiations. And I mean, one thing I can tell you, I am not, as a department, prepared to pay the same to a pharmacist for fill a prescription as I would to a physician who's going to go through a different regime. And so you start at that level and you have to work your way through it.
Yeah, okay. I appreciate that. And I think, to me, really the issue is, and I don't disagree with the member for Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville, I hope I got his riding right, but I don't disagree with him that those are potentially good things, but the fact is that they haven't happened and we don't have a timeline for them happening, and the minister and the government made it seem like those were going to happen imminently. And I know, in fact, in speaking to a number in my constituency of pharmacists, they frequently get people coming in assuming that those things have actually already happened and that the pharmacists can do it, and they actually get upset with pharmacists because they say, well, the government said that you can renew a basic prescription or you can do this, when in fact they can't do that at the moment because the government hasn't finished negotiations and hasn't implemented the policy.
There's a difference between can't and won't, and it's overpay. So.
Well, they can't, though. They are you telling me that the pharmacist under...
Pharmacists for years have been able to do some refills on certain prescriptions, and the mechanisms are there and some of the things, but it comes down to being paid for, so that's what we're working our way through.
Well, of course it comes down to being paid for, because the government reduced the amount that they get on other things on the promise that they would get paid for these things through a tariff, which is why you're having the negotiation at the moment.
Correct.
So they might have done it before had they not, for free, had they not lost the, or had they not been reduced on the other end. It was a negotiation. The Minister of Health stood up in this House and said that, and said it was going to be a trade-off.
Yep. So we are in negotiations. But again, when you work hard to save money for individuals, for government, the government's not going to turn around and pass it all back in a different mechanism. So otherwise, there'd be no savings to anybody. We may as well let the companies give the marketing money to pharmacies.
And that's fine. My point is it was misleading for the minister. That's not really my point. My point is it's misleading for the minister to stand up last year and say this was all going to happen at once and make people feel like they'd be able to do this, when in fact that wasn't the case. At no time, in fact, it was the minister led the media and the public to believe that it was just a matter of cabinet signing off on a policy and it would happen. And of course, that's not the case, as you just said. There's a need to negotiate those. And I agree you've got to save money. My point is it's important for the minister to be honest about what the timeline was and not mislead.
I think the minister was honest. I think that we're working hard to make it happen. I think to infer the minister was dishonest is not correct.
Well, I think it was misleading.
I disagree with that as well.
And I think a lot of pharmacists would suggest it is, because they're hearing from the public on that. So, moving on to some of the other items, in the Ross report, which obviously a lot of this comes out of, on page 29 of that report, it said that Dr. Ross says, quote, we continue to try and pay for everything within a budget that is unrelated, unresponsive to the pressures from within. And this leads to unacceptable wait times and one crisis after another. And you kind of alluded to a similar thing. And what I'm wondering is, he talked about the idea that block funding is a problem and actually increases wait times. And so I'm wondering if the department has begun to look at performance-based funding, which he alluded to.
Okay, we are working with physicians on a number of things. One is we're going through a new process on the AP funding, which deals with how do we get accountability built into our system and what do we get for what we're paying. So we are working through that process. It does involve not just the Department of Health. It involves the physician groups. It involves doctors in Nova Scotia. Same when we're looking at the fee schedule. We're looking at appropriateness of fees. Some of the fees haven't been reviewed for years, so we're going through a process. And we have to start, for example, if you look at what we pay for cataract surgeries, is out of whack for the amount of time that individuals do that operation at the present time. It was initially established when you did one per hour, and now they do six per hour, so we got to look at that. On the other hand, there are some other procedures where we're not paying as much as we should. So, but it is a tremendous amount of work. We do have a team on it, and we will get it in place. But it's not an overnight process. One of the difficulties we're having with all of these things is we're starting from scratch on many things and starting to build a new system and trying to, unfortunately, we're trying to fix things for years, and it's not easy.
I agree. But on the specific issue of performance-based funding, right, is that something that in these discussions you're looking at?
People are going to be held accountable for what they're paid for. So
is that a yes?
Yeah, that's a yes in a way. It's probably a different wording, but it means the same.
No, and that's fine. I'm just trying to get at whether, and I understand that, you were clear that it is a negotiation and a discussion. I'm just wondering, is it?
People are going to be held accountable for dollars, and that's what we have to work our way through. It's system by system. We have to do that, and it's not easy. And the physicians are individual businesses, whether they admit it or not. So even though they're represented by Doctors Nova Scotia, they all have independence. So you have to. It's a convoluted process. It's not. Getting a negotiated agreement with, for example, a union is convoluted enough. And doctors, where they're independent, it's a lot harder. But we will get there. And there is a commitment from Dr. Nova Scotia as well to work with us, so I don't want to malign physicians when I'm saying that. I'm just saying there's so many parties to it. It makes it more interesting and challenging.
Yeah, and I don't think I didn't have the impression you were maligning doctors in that at all. I just, it was more a question of, is that something that's on the table? On page 13 of the Better Care Sooner Plan, it talks about spending $2.5 million to directly help hospitals find doctors for hard-to-fill shifts. How much of that has been spent on actually helping hospitals find doctors?
Was it hospitals or communities?
It says hospitals.
We have spent money. For example, I can't give you the dollars off the top of my head, and maybe while Linda's trying to look there. What we have spent, doctors money, for example, to support some extra physicians in the Tatamagush area, some of the other communities. We are also looking at a process to do a locum emergency program in the next year, but that's not part of the past, so I can't speak to that, which is what we're here to talk to. And they're trying to find the figure as I'm trying to drag out the time.
I know, so am I.
Ms. Penny?
Okay, so we've in 11-12, we've spent about $544,000 to help ER coverage, and in the previous year, it was about $1 million. I'm just rounding it to about $1 million.
All right. In that previous year...
10-11, yeah.
Yeah, where you were talking about $1 million that was spent, and that was on hospitals finding doctors. I'll tell you why I ask, because the minister last year in question period said not a dime had been spent on that. You're saying $1 million had.
Yeah, this is actually for physicians to provide ER coverage, to keep the coverage in the ERs.
No, that's good. That's just the complete opposite of what the minister said in question period last year. That's why.
So there's a lot of numbers around this, broad. So that's just the first one that we pulled out.
No, that's fine. That's why I'm asking, is because it said this was a specific commitment on a specific amount.
Mr. McNamara?
Verify the two.
Sure.
The two. I think the question we were talking about was the ER Protection Fund. Did money come from it? The answer last year was no, it did not, because we had the money within our own budget. We didn't have to go to that extra fund and ask for it. So that's why it's different, even though it's the same. We did spend the dollars. We just didn't go to that particular fund and ask central government to give us a drawdown.
So you spent the money, but you spent it from
within
existing
our own
budget. And so that $2.5 million is still there in...
Well, each year it's there to work towards, and that's we definitely have plans for this year with the expansion of our CEC.
So is that okay? Then the next question with that is, if it's every year, is that if none was spent in one year, does that make it five the next, or is it just a $2.5 million fund?
Well, it's Linda,
Ms. Penny?
That.
It's actually a $3 million fund, and in 10-11 we spent out of the department's budget $3,179,000 of items that would have qualified for the fund, but we were able to cover it because we had a surplus.
Okay.
So that's why you didn't see 10-11. In 11-12, we are forecasting to spend over $2.8 million of the $3 million.
Okay. That makes sense. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. With the CECs, and I apologize, I'm just over back and forth all over the place. I just obviously only have a few minutes left. What I'm wondering, and I know you probably don't have this at the moment, but I'm wondering if you could table it with the committees, is the annual operational costs for the CEC model in Parsborough, and I guess Spring Hill's open now, which is good, and show, and what I'm interested in, not the annual operating costs, as well as to provide some documentation which would show the annual operating cost in the same facility before it was a CAC. And I realize it's not just about money, because I think you're probably going to say it's not just about money, and I do understand that, but I'm interested in comparing the two.
Mr. McNamara?
Yes, we'll get that for you.
Okay, I appreciate that. And how is it captured with the CECs when, obviously, there's a referral process. If I refer somebody off-site to another facility, does that cost then get transferred into the facility to which they're transferred to, or is that it remains in the CEC?
It remains.
Okay.
The way we fund facilities is facility by facility, so the funding doesn't follow the patient. It's with the facility.
All right.
I think I'm answering your question, but...
Yeah, you are. But it actually raises another question that I've heard come up lately, which is, are you looking at money that follows the patient?
Not at this point in time. To get there, it takes a lot of work to get to the case costing and all the things to go with it, and so we are a long ways from that.
All right. Excuse me. In terms of the QE2 and the operating, or not the operating, sorry, the emergency facility there, I know some additional money was put in there. They are still obviously another site that's dealing with routine overcrowding. I would say it's probably a little bit better, but what is the plan there to continue dealing with that issue?
Well, as I mentioned, we've been meeting with Capital Health on things that we can do to try and alleviate the situation. Unfortunately, in the immediate...
Order, time, please. Unfortunately, okay. Mr. Younger's time has expired. Okay. Mr. McMaster.
Mr. Chair, my first question is about... one of the things I've heard on my travels is that there are people out there who are not calling the 911 line to get a... to get an ambulance to take them to the hospital because they're afraid of the bill. So they're choosing, in some cases, to drive themselves, and that could be very risky if they could be taking a heart attack or a stroke. Is there a way that, I guess one of my ultimate questions here is going to be, you know, what would the cost be just to pay for that service, so that if somebody calls looking for an ambulance, it's paid for by the government. But even before I ask that question, is there any way that the system can analyze a call to make sure it is worthy of an ambulance response in an emergency case?
Mr. McNamara?
Yeah, I'll start, and maybe Ian can. One of the things we've been struggling with is on that. For example, if somebody calls an ambulance, the paramedic is almost, particularly even if the individual wants to, has to transport them. They don't have the right to say no, and so that's one of the things that we've been looking at. Is there other possibilities? But yes, the EHS can assess, for example, and with the individual decide that it's not appropriate to transport. We also know that if you show up at an individual's residence and do that assessment, there's no cost. It's only when there is an actual transport. The second thing, we also recognize that there are individuals who are hardship cases, And what we do, there is ways around that. For example, it can be as, is it $10 a month is the minimum, or $5 a month payment if that was necessary. There are cases where we have written off when there's particularly real hardships. So we do try to look at, but again, for all of us, I think we have to encourage people to call 911. Even if you end up paying for it, it's worth our life to do that. And it's infrequent that people are having multiple calls. Mm-hmm. And we are looking, is there other ways to try and help individuals? One of the things that on a go-forward basis is even looking at individuals for transfers between long-term care facilities. How can we reduce that cost? Because it comes out of individuals' comfort allowance.
Okay. And just what would the cost be if the government chose to cover the cost? Is it? Could you give a rough estimate?
I think we've got a note on the amount. I can get you the actual amount. I don't have it right in front of me.
If you could.
But I will say, one of the things we have to be concerned about, too, is that it doesn't become what I would call a taxi service, because that can happen as well. And the experience in other provinces that have done away with fees, it's become the opposite problem, is that people use it for everything. And so we've got to, it's a balance that we have to work our way through. And recognizing that Nova Scotia has the most sophisticated EH system in the country. I mean, even when we do a comparison of prices, we're about the middle of the pack. But some of the ones that are charging higher don't have the level of sophistication our system does.
Thank you. My next question is around collaborative emergency centers. Would you consider something like this? Is something being like this being considered for, say, the hospital in Inverness?
It's not on the initial list at this time. It doesn't mean it's out of the question for the future. I mean, I think what we have to do is, as we're gaining experience and see the acceptability, and saying there may be more facilities we can add to it, I think what we want to do is ensure that the facility is there 24/7 for individuals.
Okay. Is there a recognition of the need to get buy-in from the communities where you're implementing these CECs?
There is, and we've been going through meeting with community groups. We've gone, in fact, in Tatamagush, for example, we were having some challenges with the staff, and not in a bad way, because they just didn't understand the system. So myself, the CEO of the area, Emily, the College of Nurses, Dr. Ross by telehealth, the physician from me, we all went and met the whole group there and talked about what the challenges were, how we could help and support them, what is there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're prepared to do whatever is necessary. The other thing we also recognize that when a CEC is open, we have to put out communications to that particular area so they understand the expectation of what you can get when you arrive at a CEC and what you cannot expect. And we haven't even really done a good job in the past of saying what you can expect when you show up at an ER. So this is an improvement in that way, even.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I can say, as a member of the legislature, I don't mind seeing changes in things like the healthcare system, but I think it's very important that people understand what the changes are, because they're very defensive about protecting what they have. And I can think right now in Inverness, which is covering the western side of Cape Breton Island. The discussion around emergency surgery, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that's an issue. The way it came out, people got very upset about it, very concerned about it. I learned a lot more about emergency surgery myself.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, if somebody needs, if it's cardio surgery or ortho surgery, well, that's really specialized. And it is in people's best interest to have somebody who's doing that kind of work every day. It's very specialized work, and we all want to be kept put in the best hands of care. So I guess I just want to make that point of the importance of, and if you want to make any comment on that,
sure.
the importance of making sure that people understand what's going to happen before it just happens.
I will tell you this, if I get my knuckles wrapped by the minister, it's usually for not doing the consultation. And so, and that's happened a few times. So sometimes we haven't been as diligent as we should have been as a department.
Okay. Do you have a thought on, like, what seemed to happen there? There appears to have been some surgeries happening that were not necessary to happen after hours. But that said, there are a number of surgeries that have been performed there over the years. We had a young girl here yesterday who had started a petition. and her sister was born by way of emergency surgery in Inverness years ago, and it was on a Saturday evening. So there are times, they may be very rare, maybe it's 5 or 10 times a year, when I think emergency surgery would be needed in an area like that, because it's 2-plus hours away from Antigonish or Sydney. Do you have any thoughts on trying to maintain that service in a place like Inverness?
Well, as you know, at the present time, it's looking at the evening and weekend hours is where the reduction is. And we look at the numbers. So it's how do you justify, I guess, and the safety of doing this? I think one of the things we have to look at, not just there, but across this province, how do we provide safe surgery? And we're looking at how do we have a surgical program? And maybe as we can get our technical expertise and some other things in place, we can do more eventually. But right now, just... and then we also recognize there is a glitch, or can be a glitch at times, if you got a major storm or if the causeway is closed, for example, which does create. So we recognize that's there. At the same time, we also know we have the best EHS system in the place. We do have a life flight. We do have ways of working around it. Weather bearing. We do have those glitches that occasionally occur, but they occur, unfortunately, even in places where we do have good facilities and we have to transfer patients. Mm-hmm. So it's but we have to work on making sure we have the best standards that we're providing care. And that's always the hardest part, is working mm-hmm. through the quality at the same time of trying to provide a good service mm-hmm. and making sure that people know that what the expectation of what they can get is correct. Mm. And there's an assumption sometimes that surgery means any kind of surgery, and it isn't, as you've learned in your homework.
And I know that there's, you know, surgeons used to do every kind of a surgery, no matter what it was, they would. And I know that things are becoming more specialized now. I guess in rural areas, one of the concerns is that while we appreciate the quality of care mm-hmm. and the need to have very high standards, we also realize that if you completely remove a service, doesn't matter how high the standard is, if the service is gone, mm-hmm. it's gone. And that's an issue of quality care too, because if you had internal bleeding after an operation that day and it was in January and you were going to get in an ambulance and drive not across the Trans-Canada but over a mountain through snow-covered roads to get to another hospital, you might want to take your chances mm-hmm. with somebody who's been a surgeon for 25 years in Inverness. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, taking your chances is the word I don't like. But anyway, I think what we still have to make sure that that we can provide good services. So sometimes physicians can still do something in true emergencies with no other chairs. I mean, it's no different than a physician who runs across a car accident on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. What you expected or what you would do in that case is much different than in a sterile mm-hmm. hospital room. So sometimes you have to act with what you have and do your best. But, I mean, that would be no different if you lived on... Well, we have individuals live on Tancook Island, for example, who are even more further away from having a service than you would in Inverness. So, mm-hmm. But Inverness does have some good services, and they can support most individuals at most mm-hmm. times.
Well, I think maybe we're closer on the same page there. But the reason I use taking a chance, I guess, is because a lot of people see getting in the ambulance to go to the regional hospital as taking an even greater chance mm-hmm. with their life. Mm-hmm. The next question I'd like to ask is... have you considered recognizing that in rural areas, and Inverness serves, of course, more rural communities beyond Inverness, because it's sort of the hospital for the western side of the island, but when you look at surgery, and if you have a surgeon in Inverness, we've got some who are probably going to retire in the next few years, have you ever considered trying to keep capacity in an area like Inverness for, say, something like surgery, for daytime surgery, by means of maybe farming some surgeries out of the regional centers into a rural area? That way you have a surgeon in the rural area who there can be a case to keep them there, and also, of course, that bolsters the quality of care in that area.
What we're going through right now, we have Dr. Carmen Giacomantonio, who's with Cancer Care Nova Scotia, looking at surgery for me province-wide. What are the things that we should do? How should we do it? We also have to set up surgical standards. We started, as has been mentioned in this program, of having standards for ERs. Surgeries and pathology and diagnostic imaging have to follow. And so we're starting down that path as well. And that will guide us on what's the right thing to do in order to to provide the appropriate and safe care for Nova Scotians.
Okay. Well, I would. That's good that that work is happening, and I would ask that when something comes of that work, that the communication of it to the people so they understand is very important. Because there's decisions going to be made to change things. If people don't buy in locally, it's very hard for anybody to be supportive of that.
I understand that. And you're talking about surgery. I was just thinking as you were going, and as a young child, I lived in rural Cape Breton, and I had surgery done in the doctor's office on my neck in here. So it's changed a lot from those days. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to go back and do that again.
I know. I know. Yeah. And I guess what people see, though, is, you know, they don't have the same knowledge that you have, obviously.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we fail to talk about is quality and safety as much as we should.
Okay. I'm almost out of time here. There's one item I would like to ask, and that was there was some numbers on the advertising. If those could be perhaps emailed to the committee chair, that would be appreciated. See if I can ask a couple other quick ones here.
Ms. Penny, could you give us a commitment to do that, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I think I just have time for... I might have time for a couple. Have you ever considered showing people the bill for the services they've received? Not to make them feel guilty or bad, but just to give them an appreciation for the support we have in the province to help people when they need our health care system.
I think we have to be innovative and think of how we do that. Even doctors do not know the cost of the services they provide, quite honestly, and we have to start even there. It was tried many years ago, I remember it, and it was during, in effect, a conservative government that sent individuals out and say, here's what it cost. It created a major uproar. A lot of people thought it was bills, so that's what I'm talking about. We have to be very careful. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to start thinking as we cost things out to let people know, but yet not in a way so that they don't use services, it's so they use them appropriately.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. One last quick one. Inverness CT scan. Why delay the purchase of a CT scan if it's going to save travel dollars and pay for itself within a year or two?
We're looking at one. I don't even think I have a process from the district for approval of CT scan.
Order, please.
So it's in their hands.
Mr. McMaster's time has expired. Mr. McKenna.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be sharing time with Mr. Scobar and Mr. Smith, so perhaps I'll try to keep the question short, but if the answers could even be shorter, perhaps it would be better. Situation is that on occasion, opposition parties take shots at public education campaigns. And as a former media person and a PR person, I believe that public education campaigns are very, very important. And I've never heard one negative word from a constituent in relationship to the public education campaigns, particularly in relationship to the 811 system. So I'm wondering about the impact on the usage of 811 with the public education campaign on it, because without that education campaign, people would not be fully aware of that program.
What happens when we have the high-level communication is that we get a higher call volume, and then we end up, the problem on the other side is trying to respond as quickly as we'd like to. So, yes, there is a much higher usage every time we have. And I think, as Mr. McMaster was saying, you know, we got to do a better job communicating in communities on all the things we're doing. And I think that is important.
Thank you. The Pictou County Health Authority has been looking at an expanded ER and pharmacy. This is major structural changes that would be taking place there, multi-million dollar changes. In fact, the budget just presented yesterday does, in fact, have money allocated for that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And a significant amount?
I don't have the amount.
Thank you.
As we're still in the planning and design phase, we didn't really want to put the amounts out there because then the contractors know ahead of time what's available. So there's funding in the budget, definitely.
And I was only going to ask two quick questions, and I already have, but Mr. Younger has, in fact, encouraged me to ask another one, because he was talking about the expanded role of pharmacists and the negotiations that were taking place and so on, and talked about the generic drug situation as well. Now, my only sibling, my brother, a pharmacist, owned his own store for his own pharmacy for several decades, and informed me that he used to get well in excess of $100,000 a year in rebates. And we didn't do what Ontario did in moving very quickly on those. We came in with a gradual reduction in the rebates and not wiping them out totally. Have we seen savings to seniors and others already in relationship to that? Because I think that's a very important step taken by this province.
Yes, we have seen savings as a government. But in addition to savings by the government, there are individuals who go and purchase their own drugs. I've also had the same savings. So it's been the pharmacists have applied it equally across the board. And I would give them credit because they didn't have to. And they've been, so I think they deserve credit for having done that.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn over to Mr. Scarrer.
Thank you very much, and I am glad to hear that the pharmacists have taken up the mantle and shared those savings with individual consumers. I just want to get back to the CECs for a moment. Cumberland County was the home of the first CEC in Parsborough, and the one opened up in Pugwash. Now, earlier in your statements, you mentioned that the Parsborough CEC had seen 4,800 patients, and that the nighttime patients were reduced by 50%. I thought that would have been a little bit more. If I recall correctly, when Dr. Ross did his assessments of emergency rooms in rural communities, that the vast majority, something like upwards of 90% of the patients he saw when he took a couple of shifts there, were non-emergency cases, that the reason they were there is because they didn't have access to primary health care. So I thought the number of nighttime patients would have been reduced by more than 50%.
Well, so I think some individuals know that they can get quick access at night, and some people work different shift works, they work different times, so this is why you get some of it. I can't explain it all, but overall it's been positive. I think one thing just to talk about Parsborough, and I'll get Emily maybe give you a couple of better facts than I can give you, is that with changing that and the physicians not having to be called at night, in effect it's really provided one more physician during the day, because you take that 40 hours a night becomes a more hours that are available, so it's almost like recruiting one new doctor during the day.
There may continue to be opportunities to reduce the number that are visiting by night. If you look at the statistics right now, 33% of the patients that are going there at night are treated and sent home. 44% are treated and sent to the primary care unit the next day for follow-up. So there are patients that continue to go there for whatever reason that continue to seek primary care. So, you know what, as we continue to work with the community and as they become more comfortable with the services, we may, in fact, continue to see that switch, but we're pretty pleased right now with the fact that it has been a 50% reduction due to the increase in access in primary care during the day.
So it sounds like the culture of going to the outdoor, to the emergency, just hasn't been, it's still there, that people go after hours because that's what they've always done.
It is certainly changing. So we're now seeing 50% less. Probably over the next 6 months, we'll continue to see a drop in that number. But you're right. It is a change in culture. It's a change in a routine that's been there for many, many years when you would go for primary care to your emergency room. But that is changing, and we have seen this change happen over the last 8 months since Parsborough has been open.
And even though it's only been 8 months, I live in Amherst, and Amherst is kind of the center for shopping, and a lot of people go to Amherst on a regular basis. People have been coming to my office and saying, why can't we have a CEC? Because they do have access to primary health care, from 8 to 8. seven days a week, and that's still something that many people have a difficult time with in places where the ER doesn't close. One of my colleagues asked about the operating cost of CECs. I'm interested in finding out as well. Now, my understanding was that it would be probably about the same, break-even point from what it was before, considering how much we were paying emergency room physicians to stay there, to stay there all night. That is my guesstimate. Are we somewhere in that neighborhood, do you think?
There is some additional cost. I mean, if you say the physician was paid at night, but now we're paying them to do more during the day, so the money's being utilized. Then we have added paramedics, for example, or a nurse in some cases. We've had some construction cost in some areas. So the CECs is not a money-saving venture. It is a venture to provide 24/7 emergency care to individuals in the community.
That would be better care sooner. Then.
That's correct.
Okay. One last thing. You mentioned that when a CEC was to be implemented in a new community, that there was more anxiety from the staff than from the patients or the community. What's the nature of the anxiety from that?
Well, it comes from a number of things. One is that people are, what happens to my job? That's obviously the first one, and that's normal. I mean, that's a natural phenomenon with individuals when you go through change. Secondly is, how am I going to cope not having a doctor with me, because I've been used to being able to call the doctor at home who can come in, but there is, with the medical oversight, they still have that. It's just going through a new process, and anytime any of us change, and if you lose what you feel is your life vest, it's just, what's a new way of doing it? So it takes a little bit of time for people to get used to it, but we are finding that those that have been in it and find that it does work, and they do feel comfortable. It's just going through the process of change.
One more little comment there before I pass the floor on to my colleague. Years ago, I started my career up in northern Manitoba, where long before satellite phones and radio phones, and before I think the term nurse practitioner was developed, and I'd seen a team of young nurses there in the course of an evening deal with a gunshot wound and deliver a baby before supper, and the patients were medevac when they could, but that always didn't happen. And I'm glad we're finally kind of catching up to the whole concept and formalizing the way that should be done.
I just hope they don't deal with gunshot wounds, not transfer them.
The gunshot wasn't the baby. No, it was different ones, yeah. Anyway,
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to start by putting a plug in for 811. Last evening, I had a call from home, and my wife was telling me that her brother was having chest pains. And he was reluctant. They live about 15 miles away from the hospital, and he was reluctant to get 911 involved, and his wife remembered about 811 and called, and on the advice that they got there, they got him to the hospital. So it's working. I guess the other thing, but what gives rise to a question from that is, do you find that because of 811, people are not using 911 as much? Is that...
can you try that?
Sure.
Mr. Bauer.
Sure, thank you. We absolutely would not want 811 to discourage people from using 911. I think to a point that was made earlier, but we want emergency to go to 911 and call 911. However, if you do call 811 and it is deemed an emergency, you're moved right through to the 911 system with little delay, no calling back, that kind of thing. So we are hoping that 811 is not creating a negative impact on the 911 calls for the appropriate calls, but 811's intention and design is to appropriately direct people to the appropriate part of the healthcare system, which, for the service, over 30% of that is not going anywhere, but providing good advice and good self-care.
Sure.
And some of it may be seeing a family doctor, and some of it may be going to the IWK or to another emergency department.
Thank you. In your Minister, in your opening address, you talked about the new fixed wing aircraft, and I'm just wondering about. And you mentioned that it's something that is used in the maritime provinces, not just in Nova Scotia. Is there a cost sharing of that?
We have an agreement with those provinces to get repaid for when it is used,
okay.
And it also applies in the helicopter service as well. So
great. Okay.
They've just been recently renegotiated.
Just wanted to know how generous we were on that one.
We used to be generous, but not longer.
Okay. On the issue of palliative care, this is a particular concern in my community. Can you tell us if there are any plans for expansion or where we're going with that?
As the minister announced in February, we started providing free drugs for individuals
yes,
at home during
that,
the last
yeah.
6 months, or what is expected to be the last 6 months of life. We do have in the department somebody who was leading palliative care, moved on to another position, but we are now bringing somebody else in to look at what we can do, because that is an interest of the minister, and has asked us to look at how we can provide better palliative care in our communities. And there's also a lot of interest from communities in trying to do their own things around palliative care,
yes.
respite beds, etc.
Right, okay. And just quickly before I run out of time, we recently had in Antigonish the stroke unit come there. Can you just tell us about the effect of that and how it...
Okay, the great thing about the one in Antigonish is an agreement between two district health authorities in order to bring enough expertise together to look after stroke patients in one place. The effect, it started in Yarmouth as a project, had great results, and what we're finding is that it does provide better care to stroke victims, and it does allow more of them to go home and to be rehabilitated.
Mm,
a very positive program.
Okay. Thank you. We're lucky to have it. Thank you. That's it for me.
Yes, so time is... We only have 10 seconds left, so I guess we're finished. With that, I'd ask Mr. McNamara if there's any closing comments you would like to make or any of your staff.
Sure. Just very first to thank the committee for the opportunity to come and talk about better health care. It is something that the minister is extremely interested in and keeps challenging us to do more. One of the things that was not in my talk or else that I should mention is that the minister did change the policy last year that we could provide some capital funds to community health centers to be able to renovate or rebuild. So, for example, there's been funds provided in Aarschot, in Shelburne and Digby, I think was the third one. So this is a new policy. In the past, if they were not part of a district health authority, it couldn't happen. And I think this is very positive, and this is something we can look on in the future to be able to help, particularly a number of our small rural communities.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Auditor General, have any comments today?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have anything further to add today. Thank you.
Great, thank you. There was three items that I noted, and the clerk might have noticed some other ones. Mr. Porter asked some information about dialysis, different locations that some people may be able to go. There was also a request from Mr. Porter for information how you access, I believe the words were, and we'll double-check that with the clerk, the $400 a month program for palliative care at home. And Ms. Penny committed to providing the breakdown of the advertising costs of the Better Care Sooner promotional campaign. And with that, I would like to thank very much the Department of Health coming again. It's always a pleasure having you here. We see you quite often. And again, thank you very much for all the information and you provided today. We have very little committee business today. The subcommittee today will be canceled at the request of the co-chair. Evidently, he had to go on other business someplace today. And the requested information that was from Nova Scotia Office of Immigration has been provided to everybody today when you came. And our next meeting is April the 11th, next Wednesday, with Efficiency Nova Scotia and Efficiency and Demand Side Management Fees. And without anything else that anyone has, a motion to adjourn would be in order. Mr. Younger, we stand adjourned.